Good afternoon. House Judiciary Committee is in session. It's 1:15. We have two bills before us today. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Grunberg, Representative Ramirez, Representative Holmes, and Representative Gatto. I think Representative Coghill will be along, and Representative Dahlstrom is trying to make it from Anchorage to Juneau. We have two pieces of legislation before us today. We're going to take up House Bill 137 first, which I just added my name to as a co-sponsor. We're very happy to have Commissioner Ledoux with us, and Karen is here first, who's going to take us through the legislation.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Karen Litzer, and I am staff representative John Coghill. And as the chairman said, he will be here very shortly, I'm sure. In the meantime, to present HB 137 is a privilege, and I appreciate the opportunity. The House bill will eliminate some of the barriers that face children of military personnel as they transition from one school system to another. The average student moves from 6 to 9 times from kindergarten to 12th grade. With Alaska, who enjoys such a close relationship with our servicemen and women and their families, and we recognize the sacrifice and stress they face, the frequent moves and deployment, we want to try and ease some of that stress with this legislation. There are 12,106 active duty children between the ages of 5 and 18, plus the children of active members of the Guard and Reserve that will benefit from this compact. 11 states in 2008 adopted this compact, and presently 22 states have pending legislation to join. Passing this legislation will help remove some of the stress by providing the children timely enrollment as they move from one school district to another. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I could just go through the sectional articles, if that is at your pleasure. And then if there are any questions, there are a number of people here to look at this and be able to answer specific questions, or I will do the best job that I can. But whatever is your pleasure, sir.
Whatever is easiest for you, we're at your disposal. We've been joined by Representative Coghill, the prime sponsor of the bill.
Okay. If we can, then we will go through the sectional, and this will be a new chapter in AS 14, and it is the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunity for Military Children. Article 1 describes the purpose, which it is to remove barriers to educational success for military children by facilitating enrollment, placement, and timely graduation, providing enforcement of rules, uniform collection and sharing of information, and promoting coordination, flexibility, and cooperation among member states. In Article 2, it is the definition, and this article provides the definition for terms used throughout the compact. Article 3 is the applicability, and this article defines the children that will be covered by this compact. Article 4 talks about the educational records and enrollment, and it outlines how sending and receiving states handle a military student's unofficial and official educational records. The Interstate Commission determines what information must be included in the records and the timeline for providing those records. It provides a 30-day grace period for immunizations. Kindergarten and first grade entrance is addressed for both grade level and age. In Article 5, it speaks to the placement and attendance, and it describes course placement, education program placement, and special education services to address federal requirements for students with disabilities. Placement, flexibility, and absences related to deployment are also addressed. In Article 6, the eligibility, This provides information on enrollment eligibility. It prevents students from being charged a tuition if the student lives in a different jurisdiction, and allows a student to continue to attend the school they were enrolled in while residing with a custodial parent. The military student shall have as many opportunities as possible to participate in extracurricular activities, even if they have missed application deadlines. In Article 7, it speaks to graduation, and this article facilitates on-time graduation by providing procedures for waivers, exit exams, and transfers during a military student's senior year. Article 8 is the state coordination, and it establishes the requirement for creation of a state council or other existing body to provide coordination among its government, local, and military agencies. Membership requirements are also addressed. Article 9 is the Interstate Commission on Educational Opportunity for Military Children, and this article deals with creating the commission and its responsibilities, powers, and duties. It details membership, voting rights, meetings, the executive committee, bylaws, rules, data collection, and a process for reporting alleged violations. In Article 10, the powers and duties of the Interstate Commission are listed, which address dispute resolution, promulgate rules, issue advisory opinions, enforce compliance, and other duties and powers relating to the establishing and running and supporting the state councils at a national level. Article 11 is the organization and operation of the Interstate Commission, and it provides the structure for the Interstate Commission to organize, establish bylaws, set up executive and other committees, establish procedures for meetings, and provides for the startup rules for the initial administration of the compact. Article 12 is the rulemaking function, and it gives the Interstate Commission rulemaking authority and rulemaking guidelines, and has a provision for judicial review of a proposed rule. Article 13 is the oversight, and it addresses the oversight, enforcement, and dispute resolution specifically. With the oversight, it charges the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of state governments regarding the purpose and intent of the compact. It further states that the Interstate Commission shall receive all service of process and has standing to intervene. It further addresses consequences of default by a member state. Regarding dispute resolution, if requested, the Interstate Commission will attempt to resolve disputes and provide rules for mediation and binding dispute resolution. Under enforcement, the Interstate Commission shall enforce the rules and provisions of this compact and may initiate legal action to enforce compliance with the provisions of that compact. Article 14 addresses the financing. It provides a method for the Interstate Commission to pay its reasonable expenses by collecting annual assessments from each member state. There will be an audit that will be required yearly by a certified or licensed CPA. Article 15 speaks to the member states and that the states that are eligible to become members. The compact becomes effective when no less than 10 states enact the compact into law. Rules for how amendments become effective and binding are also addressed in this article. The next Article 16 talks about withdrawal and dissolution, and it speaks to how a member state may withdraw from a compact, what the responsibilities of notice, time, and assessments would be. This article also addresses reinstatement and compact dissolution. Article 17 is severability and construction. The provisions of this compact are severable, and any portion deemed unenforceable does not affect the remaining compact. The compact should be liberally construed, and nothing in this compact inhibits other interstate compacts. And Article 18, the binding effect Nothing in this compact prevents the enforcement of other laws that are not inconsistent with this compact. Conflicting laws are superseded by the compact to the extent of the conflict. All rules of the Interstate Commission are binding on the member states. Any provisions that exceed constitutional limits are ineffective to the extent of the conflict of the member state. In section 1434.020, it establishes a compact administrator and lists out the duties of that office. In 1434.030, it establishes the State Council as a subcommittee. The regulations in 040, they may be adopted by the board to implement this chapter. 090 describes the short title, and then we have the indirect court rule amendments that we have a change in the Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure in Court Rule 4 and in Court Rule 24B. And that...
Well done. Thank you for reading that onto the record, Karen. We appreciate that. Do any of the members have questions for Karen? We do have in the room Commissioner Ledoux. I'll remind members. So, we have Carol Como available by phone, who wishes to testify, as does Thomas Hinton, the Undersecretary of Defense, and Rick Masters with the Council of State Governments, just to give members a sense of who intends to testify, along with our friend Eddie Jean. So, with that,
I do have a question
for the sponsor, and then Representative Lynn, sir.
Through the chair. Ms. Lidster, I have some questions about the wording of the compact and the effect of the compact. Should I ask the undersecretary or the person from CSG those questions?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, perhaps the gentleman from CSG, since they actually are the ones that basically put the compact
together. From CSG?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, just a brief comment and then a question. I'm a parent of six kids, military retiree, and all six kids were in my household while I served in the military, and four of the six were at some grade level in school from kindergarten up through high school. And my typical assignment in the military was about every 2 years we moved someplace, including overseas. And it was quite a hassle, I'm here to tell you, as a parent of these school-age kids, to do that. And I wish we'd had a compact, something like this at the time. My kids were military brats, and I was still in the military. And the question I have is, what are the other states that are signing this compact to date? And are they states with other major military installations of the same general job type? For example, you have bases specialized in certain things, and typically they're transferred to other bases that specialize in the same thing. Do you know that? Or maybe somebody else might have the answer.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, I know at this point that we are just waiting for Mississippi to join in and sign. The bill is on the...
You have one Air Force base in Mississippi.
We have right now 11 states that have adopted it. 12 states have enacted the compact. I think specifically what the states and what their specific military
mission
would be would probably best be directed to Mr. Hinton.
Because typically, Mr. Chair, military transfer from one base to another, but within the same mission category with the same jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the sponsor? Karen, wonderful job. Thank you for putting that on the record. If we could have you come up, Commissioner Ledoux, we'd appreciate it. Okay, and Eddie Jeans is going to join us also.
Correct.
Both with the Education Department. Gentlemen, we're happy to have you. If both of you would introduce yourselves for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Larry Ledoux. I'm the Commissioner of Education and Early Development.
You're very well liked by this whole building, I might add. Nice to see you, Commissioner. Eddie, you too. You're well liked.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
Welcome, gentlemen. Uh, Do you have a presentation to make, or would you rather make yourself available for questions, which is easiest for you, Commissioner?
Reverend Ramos, I have a few short comments.
Okay.
Just
please.
Good questions.
Please.
I'm here as a Commissioner of Education, but also I'm here to share some of my experience as a 10-year high school principal in a military community and 10 years as an elementary principal in the same community. I believe that this legislation represents strong common sense for kids. Thank you. And I'm talking to my own children. I have a good voice, but I believe that the stresses on military families as they transfer back and forth, usually every 2 to 3 years, are real. I've seen firsthand the stress on young people and children in completing their education, particularly on parents who often are single parent families because of the deployment. I've also seen the stress on youngsters. It's very difficult for families to move to a new educational environment. They have to learn new pathways to parent involvement. They're very different, and parent involvement is very important. It's very difficult for them to sync up, if you will, with special education, gifted, talented programs, career technology classes, you know, that they've been involved with before, activity programs, student council, athletic activities, whatever kids do to find success for themselves. And most importantly, it's very difficult for kids to find a way to fit in, to make friends, and to find a new pathway to belong. I'm just going to share with you one example of why you can see this is necessary. And I would like to point out that the Department of Education has contacted every district that has a sizable population of military youngsters, and they are very supportive. And I'm proud to say that in Alaska, most districts follow these guidelines already. I believe one of the reasons we need the compact is to tell other states, to speak to other states, that they need to treat their kids a bit more respectfully who transfer. One example I can remember as a principal, I received a young man who was enrolling in our district the last day of finals for our high school. And he left their district down south 5 days early, and the district he was coming from refused to grant him any credit. They refused. They said he did not stay. That was their policy. He did not stay to the end of their semester. So this was a graduating senior, and they would not grant this young person credit. So I called them and I said, you're telling me then that I have to grant the student credit, and I'm seeing him one day. And they said, well, you don't have to do anything. We're just telling you that we are not granting this child credit because he left 5 days early. And so because I have to make a recommendation to the school board, you know, for graduation, that the student has met all the requirements, I can tell you that I had no problem at all recommending the student for graduation. It was silly, but it was necessary. The other comment I will have is regard to immunizations. Sometimes young people come in from military families and they do not have all of the paperwork necessary to enter into school. And so you're faced with a dilemma. Do you refuse this child who's sitting there with his book bags, frightened to death, ready to go to school? Do you say, I'm sorry, you can't go to school because we can't get a copy of your records? Well, regulations say we have to say that. But I can tell you that most principals will find a way to get those kids into school. They shouldn't have to do that. So having said that, I'm here to answer any questions that you might have regarding the compact.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't the for our intensive needs students, isn't it age 23 as the maximum age that they can attend school in the state?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I believe it's the final age if they turn 22.
Okay, 22. And I was looking in the documents here, and I didn't find it in the bill, but it's probably because I couldn't find it. But I did see it in the statements that it was for students up to age 18.
Representative Gatto, federal regulations under IDEA really govern how we work with special needs kids or youngsters with IEPs. And they're very clear that when we have a student coming into a district from another state, we honor their IEP until we have a chance to have a child study team meeting, if you will, to, you know, review it for that district. So I think we already have regulations in place with regard to kids with disabilities that this will not impact.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you've more or less addressed this. I just want to be sure that you don't see anything in this compact that is going to cause any great difficulty for implementing in any of our school districts. Is there anything in here that you think is going to be particularly difficult or financially burdensome?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I do not believe so. I believe that there will probably be problems as we implement it from here and there, as we adjust, you know, regulations if we find them. But generally speaking, most Alaskan schools follow these regulations already.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll be anxious to hear Superintendent Como's thoughts on that. I think she may be able to give us a better boots on the ground answer to that question. Are there other questions for Mr. Jeans or for the commissioner? Representative Bloomberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, does this apply to kids who are either coming into the state from homeschooling or going into homeschooling in the state if they're military families?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I believe that if they were homeschooling in the states that they came from and they moved to Alaska and they homeschool, we would treat them the same way we treat any child. And if there were regulations that got in the way of providing the needs of those homeschoolers, I think this compact would cover those students. Many homeschoolers are actually registered in state of Alaska correspondence courses, and right. So they, any student who was homeschooling through an Alaska-sponsored program would come under this act.
So the act does cover people in Alaska who are homeschooled as well as in an educational institution?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just on that point.
Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I think Mr. Gruenberg, for those who run state-sponsored distance programs, that would be true. But I'm aware of those who do homeschool totally outside, and I don't think this compact would have any impact on them.
Thank you, Representative. I'm wondering, and I should ask you as well as I'm going to ask the folks online this question too, because the jurisdiction, I'm talking to mostly the folks online now, the jurisdiction of this committee, the Judiciary Committee, is the legal issues here, and I want to be sure that this legally covers kids who were homeschooled in another state coming to this state and those who are coming into this state for homeschooling, regardless of whether it's through the department or through some other vehicle. I want to be sure that we leave no child left behind on that issue. I guess through the chair, Mr. Jeans.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, it's, as the commissioner just mentioned, it depends on if the child's enrolled in the public school system. Mm. If the child's enrolled in the public school system, the compact applies to them, coming and going. But as Representative Coghill pointed out, we have homeschoolers in this state that are the traditional homeschoolers, not a part of the public school system. The compact would not apply to them.
Okay. My next, may I ask a few dialogue, please, Mr. Chair. What is the relationship of this bill and No Child Left Behind Act? Is there any conflict, or does this intersect seamlessly with that federal law and other federal laws?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, we do not believe that there is any conflict in this bill in NCLB.
I would ask if, I'm asking, now I'm talking more to the folks on the line, I'm asking the commissioner and Mr. Jeans these questions, but folks, if your answers would differ from these witnesses, please let the committee know. If I may continue, Mr. Chair. I note that student is defined page 4, line 21, and it also deals with page 6, lines 18 to 16, as kindergarten through 12. How about pre-kindergarten?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I believe the legislation speaks to kindergarten through grade 12. Many states have a variety of programs in dealing with early learning. There is no consistency from one state to the other, and it would be very difficult to define a relationship when many states, you know, have programs that are completely opposite than what Alaska may choose to do.
So that issue has been considered, and it's impractical at the present time.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, my answer would be yes, until there's more consistency in how states approach early learning.
My next question goes to a question that Representative Berta Gardner asked in the Education Committee. She asked if these provisions concerning the compact could be applied to all children, and somebody said the answer was yes, but that you didn't want to slow this measure down by including non-military kids at this time, since our military is being deployed and these issues require urgent attention. I'm just wondering what kind of follow-up there is planned, if there is any, to include other children, and specifically but not limited to other children of other federal employees who may get transferred around the country, posted to various states, whether it's the Department of the Interior or the Department of State or postal workers, whatever. What is the next step going to be? Because we have a number of federal employees, and then, of course, we're going to have large corporate employees and stuff, but other federal employees.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Rick Masters from the Council of State Governments is the compact coordinator, writer, and developer. And so I think probably what I would do when he testifies is ask him to speak to any upcoming compacts that might deal with that issue, because I think each one would have his own specific parameters.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm referring now, I'll ask Mr. Masters that at the appropriate time. Page 8, lines 26 to 29. Oh, yes. Okay. I'm going to give you a hypothetical. The hypothetical subsection 3, and for folks online, if you don't have a copy of the bill, it's Article Roman numeral 6, small a, Item 3, dealing with basically people in loco parentis, grandparents and folks like that who have temporary or permanent custody of the kids, more temporary probably. This assumes that the child will remain in the state where they were before the parent was transferred. But it could very well be the opposite, and I'm speaking as a family attorney. I've been a family lawyer for many years. And you could have a situation where a child is in state A with the nuclear family, the parents. The parents then, for the purpose of this discussion, both being military, are deployed. And the grandparents to whom the child is being sent do not live in state A, but live in state B. The way this, and maybe I should ask Mr. Masters this question, but the phrasing on lines 28 and 29 seem to assume that they're going to continue in state A, but it may very well be they would go to state B, because it says, quote, may continue to attend the school in which the student was enrolled while residing with the custodial parent. I would think it should say, or another appropriate school where the in loco parentis resides. Any comment from you folks, or should I ask Mr. Masters?
To the Chair, Representative Gruenberg, I would prefer you ask Mr. Masters on that. It's too convoluted for me to venture.
Mr. Masters, I will ask you. Thank you. I think that completes my questions.
Thank you. Are there other questions for the Commissioner, Mr. Jeans? Representative Blanchard?
I'd just like to make a comment. I wish you had been the principal at some of the schools where my kids were transferred as I moved around the country, because you make a lot of common sense.
Chair, Representative Lynn, I thank you for the compliment. I'm proud to be in a state where the state of Alaska and how we treat people generally do not need this act. And we have great people. And I would say, too, in reference to a question that Representative Gruenberg asked, and that is that, you know, this is a common sense law. And I believe that it sets a pattern for how we treat all students that transfer into Alaska. And I think you'll find that pattern in Alaska.
Thank you, Commissioner. Anything, would you like to add anything, Mr. Jeans?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to mention that the State Board of Education supports this piece of legislation. We've received support from Kodiak, Anchorage, and Sitka, as well as the Alaska Schools Activities Association. So there's a lot of support for this legislation.
Thank you. We appreciate that. If you'll hold it just for a second, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. As Representative Gruenberg mentioned, we're dealing with a legal document here. Is there some way to use this system so that you would allow your child to stay with Aunt Mary and Uncle Joe while you and your spouse are moving throughout the nation, and have the state of Illinois, where they live, be required, if they're a compact member, be required to educate that child? I didn't see a reference in the state where the military parent resides.
Mr. Chair, I think I could answer that.
Well, first I'll give the opportunity to the commissioner.
All right.
Commissioner, do you wish to defer to Representative Gruenberg? Would you like to offer an answer on your own, or do you want us to call Nettie's and we could...
If you would look at page 8, what I was just referring to, Carl, page 8, lines 26 to 29.
Chairman, the floor to the
commissioner. Chairman Ramirez, I'm happy to take the lifeline offered by Representative Gruenberg.
I will defer to Mr. Masters, but I think Representative Gatto might look at page 8, lines 26 to 29. That was what I was referring to.
Representative Ramos, what I would say, it's been my own experience, and Carol is, our Superintendent Cuomo is online, that generally we treat the kids wherever they list. We have many kids that stay with a relative during these transitions, and we treat local parents, whoever they're residing, and we would apply the compact to the children where they're living.
So that, if I may, that is a yes then, because I was looking at the word, you know, we are illegal, transitioning, not transitioned, but transitioning. And so we're limited to that time when they're in motion, but not for the 3 years of a deployment. Is it possible if they're being deployed in a state that they feel it has inferior education that they may prefer to send their child to another state? And that would be allowed under the rules.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, it appears to be allowed. Commonly, you'll see many young people, particularly secondary students, stay behind, because they're seniors, they don't want to leave. And many times you'll actually see the child move forward and the parents will take a time catching up with the child, depending on the start of school. Many military families, because they're not paid a lot, when they do get transferred, they take vacation time. That's the only time they can, you know, vacation and move around. And so I think that this compact allows that kind of flexibility for a local district to respond to the needs of the child.
So, just the final question, I guess then, should that happen, your interpretation of a parent going from Arizona to New Mexico, placing his child in Anchorage, you would feel that, okay, as long as they were compact members, that would be all right?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I'm not sure that would be the same thing. I think that starts coming down to a personal choice of the parents to send their kids somewhere else. I think the compact was really designed the transition between two communities as they move. If I decide to send my child to Tallahassee and I'm going to Austin, that's a parental choice, not necessarily related to the movement of kids. And so I'm not sure about that.
And I only ask that because I'm not finding it as a prohibited activity.
Questions? Representative Gruenberg.
One other question, Mr. Chair. And again, Commissioner, if I should be asking Mr. Masters, I didn't realize line 28, page 8. It only refers to the continue to attend the school at which the student was enrolled. It might be that the grandparents lived, let's say, instead of Bartlett's district, they lived in East High's district or something, or they lived in Palmer instead of Anchorage. You see the problem, I see. Any answer, or should I ask Mr. Masters? Should I put him on the hot seat?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I think you can put Mr. Masters on the hot seat because he's not here. And but, you know, I would tell you that, again, that if I go through this, I can do a lot of what-ifs and put together a lot of different scenarios. But I think that, as a whole, it provides administrators in schools across the country to make sound decisions for kids. It won't be able to cover all the different possibilities that happen. But again, I think when you have quality administrators saying the child's best interests are most important here, this provides the framework for that decision making. But it won't cover every possibility. And there will be implementation noise as it goes forward, but all easily, you know.
May I ask one more question? Yes, final question?
Yeah.
Okay. Because we have three other people I think will continue to flesh out the subject.
I'll ask them.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you very much, Eddie.
Good suggestion.
And can we go to Superintendent Como, who was with us? Superintendent, thank you for taking time out of your busy day. We know.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity to testify today. I've been listening to the discussion, and I basically hope you've seen the resolution that our school board passed unanimously the 23rd of March in support of this military compact. And we believe, as Commissioner Ledoux has said, that this really institutionalizes most of the practices that I think all of us who have substantial numbers of military families have tried to implement over the years. And I think it formalizes the relationship in a sense that it allows us to give a strong message to all of our school personnel who register students, who work with families, and so forth, that these are the expectations and this is the state law. I personally believe that this compact will go a long way toward reducing the barriers and the stress on families, particularly in this difficult time of deployments. We heard from the military representative at our school board meeting last Monday night, and he was extremely grateful that we were bringing this forward because his family is much like previous testifiers in your meeting today have stated that it is really difficult for families who are undergoing a great deal of change and stress in their lives, and then you add on the military deployment component. It does put it in a different category in my mind than normal transfers and transitions for kids who parents are making the choice, whether it's through employment or a reassignment, but in most cases it doesn't involve going to war. So I hope that you'll pass this on to the next committee of referral, because we believe that by statute this will help us all. One example I'd like to give you is this fall we had a military spouse and her two high school children come in and present what it's like to be a deployed family and have the stresses of coming to a new community, having to go through all the registration, in some cases maybe have to take three different the state history and other requirements. And we really heard from the young people and the spouse how important being able to move into activities quickly to become part of the school structure and engage in school activities. So we think this is the right thing to do, and like I said, our school board passed it unanimously and with enthusiasm last Monday night.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Gatto, then Holmes and Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent Como, the state of Alaska has a requirement of Alaska history and a requirement of high school qualifying exit exams. Let's say we get a child from a high school student from for maybe only the final 6 months or the final 1 year who is not able to pass the exit exam and certainly had maybe had Iowa history instead. I don't know. What would happen in that case? Would you still be able to grant a certificate of graduation, a true Alaska diploma, or something that would be equivalent to what our students are getting?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, the law very clearly allows school districts to waive the exit exam requirement if the student has passed an exit exam in another state. And we've been able to work through all of the various state history requirements, because if they have passed their own state and it was part of the graduation requirements when they became a freshman, then we've been able to work through every one of those. We've not had difficulties with either one of those.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Superintendent, for testifying today. So I think I just want to see if I was hearing correctly. You see this more as a tool for the Anchorage School District, both within the school district and giving you some way to interact with other states, and you see it more as a beneficial tool rather than something that's going to impose additional costs and burdens on the Anchorage School District?
Yes, we don't see any negative to this at all.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. Very good. Superintendent Como, we thank you for all of your hard work and for always looking out for what's in the best interest of the children. And as somebody that that has a lot of military dependency in my district, I appreciate your point of view on this important subject.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Superintendent. Can we next go to Undersecretary Thomas Hinton, the Undersecretary of Defense. Are you with us, Secretary?
Yes, this is Thomas Hinton. I am Senior State Liaison with the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense. But thank you for that promotion. I must tell you, we are having, I am having at least some difficulty hearing some of the committee members. I'm hearing the witnesses just fine. So, so when it comes time for questions, I just wanted to mention that to you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, not to belabor the committee's time. Certainly appreciate this opportunity and appreciate the fact that Alaska is considering this legislation. Just to put a little background behind it just momentarily, and that is that the Undersecretary, about 4 or 5 years ago, discovered there were just a number of issues that were impacting our families in one way or another, that the federal government, particularly the Department of Defense, either could not or should not be involved with. Should not, of course, you know, in respect for the country's commitment to federalism, but these are a number of issues, but we developed a list of the top 10 and work on those on a continual basis, issues like in-state tuition eligibility and unemployment compensation eligibility for military spouses who have to move through no fault of their own and things like that, a number of other issues, of course. But I would say, have to say, among all of those issues, we probably hear about this one from our community, the military community, more than any other. And that's why it's been pretty exciting to work on this project and see the kind of response we've seen across the country. Just to give you an update, we're last year 11 states passed the bill and it became activated as 10, as you heard in the sectional discussion. So it became actually the fastest compact ever be activated in the history of the United States, so we're pretty proud of that. There were a lot of states that passed it last year, and then Mississippi just about 2 weeks ago signed the bill, and I'm very happy to report that just today the governor of Virginia signed the legislation after very strong support in the Virginia General Assembly, so Virginia becomes then the 13th state to participate in the compact, and as was mentioned, a number of other states are close or moving right along in their process, just like Alaska. So we're very grateful that this issue has developed as it has. I just want to let you know that it was developed over quite a long period of time. The department has worked very hard on this particular issue, but over the years it was done on an individual basis, individual school districts, sometimes states, but usually school districts. And what we noticed was, no matter how many, how much effort was put forward to make a difference in this area, and even policies that were put in place that were very friendly to military families, we kept seeing that there was a missing piece, and that was the transition, the actual movement between, and thus the coordination of what one school district and state was doing as compared to another school district and state, all with good intentions. Some with a little lack of knowledge or experience. Unlike Alaska, of course, you have much experience in this area. So we realized that an interstate compact really would be the method there, that in fact, when there is an interstate challenge, there's really only two ways to solve them. One is this way, with an interstate compact where states come together and work cooperatively to develop the same set of rules or guidelines together, and everyone has input at the table. And the other, unfortunately, is a top-down approach, sort of, from the federal government, saying this is the way it's going to happen, and it's too bad you didn't get input. So we, of course, our office is very committed to working with states, not against them. And so this was developed with the Council of State Governments. We approached them since they have a tremendous amount of experience in interstate compacts. You'll hear from Rick Masters, I believe, in a moment. I think he's on the call. And Mr. Masters is certainly the nation's leading expert on interstate compacts generally. In fact, you've heard of experts who you know, they're really an expert if they wrote the book on something. Well, he actually did. And I would recommend it to you, but I must say I've never really read it all the way through because I keep falling asleep, in all honesty. But it is full of legalese and the kind of thing that lawyers just really love. But I can recommend Rick Masters to you as one of the best experts in the country on this, so I'm glad he's here today. Just to let you know, there were a number, I will not go to the list, but there were a number of organizations that worked on this project over the period of about 18 months when we got people together and tried to discover what were the biggest issues and the biggest problems, and then what are the solutions that we can work on together. Someone mentioned earlier a question about pre-K, and that was just a really good example because that's one of the issues we realized there was such a variance among the states that we probably could not tackle anything prior to kindergarten and be successful in getting interstate compact moving. So these were the kinds of issues that were discussed. We were joined by the National Association of Elementary School Principals and the National Military Family Association, the Military Child Education Coalition, the National School Boards Association, a number of others, and legislators around the table, and hammered these things out over a period of time. So we're excited about what's happening. We're delighted that Alaska is taking a look at this. And I'm sure Rick Masters can handle a number of questions you might have, but I, too, would be certainly willing to give a shot at it if you wanted to ask me any questions.
Mr. Undersecretary, this is Chair Ramirez. As I sit and listen to your testimony and appreciate all of it, it strikes me that so often in this building we rail against the federal government and their intrusion into the state of Alaska, and yet in contrast, whenever we seem to be working with the military, because Alaska enjoys its relationship with the military so much, we almost always seem to be on the same page, and we appreciate your ringing support for this compact and for your point of view and for staying up after working hours in D.C. I know it was 6 o'clock there, and we thank you for your point of view. Are there any questions for the Undersecretary? I don't see any around this table, but we thank you for your participation in our committee process and for your ringing endorsement of Representative Coghill's effort to bring this compact before the legislative bodies up here, and we thank you, sir.
Much thanks to all of you, and again, I'll be happy to answer any questions if they happen to be any.
Thank you. I don't see any here at the table, and we thank you, Undersecretary. Can we go next to Rick Masters, who comes very highly recommended by Undersecretary Hinton. Mr. Masters?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome.
I am Rick Masters, special counsel for interstate compacts with the Council of State Governments, and I can tell I'm testifying before a judiciary committee because I haven't heard so many hypothetical since I was in law school, so certainly we'll try to respond to them, but I must first plead guilty to being an expert in this rather arcane area of the law, and the book that Mr. Hinton was referring to was published by the American Bar Association, which may mean it's even more likely to promote good sleep at night because it contains the largest compilation of legal authorities on interstate compacts that's ever been published. And certainly is a book that is useful for lawyers, but not many other folks. So I'll recommend it to you to the extent you have an interest in this area. But as Tom says, you can throw away your Ambien prescriptions with my book because 2 or 3 pages, and I guarantee you, you'll be sound asleep. So, but we are pleased to be here in cooperation and conjunction with the U.S. Department of Defense. And as many of you know, having been active in perhaps our Western Legislative Conference of the Council of State Governments, our organization during its 75-year history has been committed to the proposition that initiatives concerning areas that the states have traditionally regulated ought to continue to be managed by the states. And as Tom Hinton says, when we cross those state lines and we have an interstate problem that is nonetheless one that has its origin within state government, it's always been CSG's position that where possible we should use interstate cooperation as opposed to federal intervention. And this is one such area in which the states are coming together in an interstate compact. And as many of you already know, Alaska, as well as your sister states, are members of many compacts. Alaska, I believe, at my last count, had joined approximately 18 compacts, and I'm pleased to say that I've had experience drafting a couple of those that you've adopted, including the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. And for the last 20 years, I've been involved in either drafting or doing research or testifying or writing about this area. And while I certainly don't know everything, I can probably tell you where you can find answers if we need to. We are pleased that we have 13 states now having adopted the compact. And as Tom Hinton says, this has been an effort at which we have directed our efforts first with regard to the priority states that have the largest population of military members and installations, which certainly includes Alaska. And I think you find statistically that in approximately 20 states, we have close to 90% of our installations and personnel that are affected by this compact. And while we want all 50 states to join, certainly those top 20, of which Alaska, I think, is about number five in terms of numbers, we certainly would like to have priority with those states where most of those impacted by this compact will reside. We are attempting to create a mechanism here that is deliberately broad in its scope. And as you've noted, some of the members in your questions, that broadness sometimes is a blessing and a curse at the same time. Our goal here in the four areas that our research told us is the areas where students from K through 12 that have military parents suffer the most are in these four areas of enrollment, placement and attendance, eligibility and graduation. And what we have attempted to do is to draft some provisions that provide some broad guidance in these areas to provide what I think most lawyers would define as a reasonable accommodation for these students. We're certainly not trying to dictate to the education department how students are educated, but on the other hand, we'd like to level the playing field and have attempted to do so through the mechanism of this compact so that these students aren't unfairly penalized simply because their mother or father or perhaps both parents have chosen to serve our country in the U.S. military. And we believe that we have erected a system here that will allow these kinds of accommodations to occur. And as I think the secretary or one of the witnesses from the Education Department testified, it's kind of like the Internal Revenue Code. We can't deal with every situation, although we'd like to leave room for the ability to tackle other problems, which is why we have placed within this compact, which Karen Lister covered with you in summary fashion, a provision for some limited rulemaking to allow the member states to delve into some of these specific issues that may not be refined to the extent that we might want to, and because, as all of you recognize, this is not a static environment. There are changes that will occur within the education systems, within state government, within technology, and certainly we want to create a mechanism here that is dynamic in its nature and can be adjusted to meet these changing needs without all the member states having to go back to the legislatures to adopt new amendments, which, as all of you know, is somewhat cumbersome. And so we do have this provision for some limited rulemaking, which might be a way to take care of some of the specifics to the extent that they aren't satisfactorily dealt with. And by that, I think I'm referring to the question in part with regard to the in loco parentis situation. I don't know that we have dealt with that specifically to the extent of the question with regard to the child from state A going to state B, and whether or not you know, regardless of where the parent deploys, if the guardian is in some other state or a third state, if I understood the question correctly, what would happen then? I think the answer is we believe the accommodations would apply once they cross the state line and are living with the person who is standing in the place of the parent. But to the extent we have not succeeded in that regard, as I said, we believe that the limited rulemaking provisions that are provided in the compact would provide some means of doing that. Now, I did try to take some notes about the statements in response to questions regarding No Child Left Behind, homeschools, and jurisdiction over other children besides military kids. And if I can indulge the chair, if I may be indulged, Mr. Chair, I would like to respond to those briefly. With regard to No Child Left Behind, I would concur that we are not aware of conflicts with that federal law, and as you know, that was imposed by the Congress, and we certainly have attempted to structure this compact in a way that would not conflict with it. As to homeschools, I'd also concur with the answers that were given, and I did have a little trouble hearing some of the answers, but I think the answer that I heard was that homeschools that are totally independent of the public system were not intended to be regulated under the compact. But if there are situations where a homeschool student might be subject to the public schools regulation, then that student would be covered. But there were too many issues that were raised by totally private schools or homeschools not regulated by the public system that we felt we were opening a can of worms, so to speak, that we might regret opening. So those students were not intended to be covered. And with regard to jurisdiction over other children besides military children, that certainly is an idea that you are not the first to make an observation about or show some concern about. And frankly, we share that vision at the Council of State Governments, and there have been enough statements and concerns and questions raised about that CSG is interested in pursuing some mechanism that might apply to other kids besides just the military children. Now, because this mechanism is already in progress and we have 13 states that have adopted it, we really can't change it in the middle of the stream, so to speak, because then we'd have, you know, two different agreements. But we certainly recognize that there are other children that are affected by moves of their parents, although, you know, we certainly think there are some distinctions to be made between those that are subject to the orders of the President of the United States and have to go regardless as compared with those who probably, at least to some extent, have a choice based on their financial concerns and their own well-being. But certainly that doesn't mean that those kids shouldn't be looked at as children that may need some accommodation. So we certainly have some plans to revisit that issue, but that currently that's not part of this compact. Mr. Chair, I have tried to pick up on the questions that I was able to ascertain some answers to or comment on those that I think I was asked to, but I'm happy to answer other questions that the members may have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Masters. I think we're coming to the end of our cycle of curiosity. Representative Gruenberg?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Masters. A couple of questions here. What's the name of your book?
It's hang on just a minute. I'll get the precise title for you. It is the Changing Role and hang on just a minute.
I'm one of these guys who read Shepherds for fun and profits.
Yeah, there you go. It's the Evolving Use and Changing Role of Interstate Compacts, A Practitioner's Guide. It's such a catchy title, I almost couldn't remember it. It's a 2007 ABA publication that's available at the American Bar Association website. CSG can give you a discounted version of it for about half the price, and then I understand that recently Amazon has begun to sell this for even less. So I'm not making any money on this, but that really wasn't the point. So happy to recommend it to you.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Yeah, as a longtime member, I'm not now, but I was for many years a member of the ABA, very much respect the stuff they're doing.
Yes.
On the question of I'm going to call it the grandparent section, which was Article 9, I think.
Yes.
I would recommend, as you do your rulemaking, that you seek input from the family law section of the ABA and the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers and the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys, too.
I've actually dealt with all three groups in a couple of other compacts, so I know of whom you speak.
Okay, and if you need any help, I'm happy to. I'm a member of the Academy.
Oh, great.
Now, with respect, I'd like to focus on page 18 of the bill on the rulemaking provision, and it sounds to me like this compact envisions that there will be an interstate commission with rulemaking functions. And my question to you is a legal and constitutional one. If that commission can engage in additional rulemaking in this and other areas, has anybody checked into whether that's an unconstitutional delegation of legislative powers from this?
There is a Supreme Court citation on that issue. It's a good question, and the question was raised and adjudicated in a case called West Virginia X. Rel. Dyer versus Sims, and the Supreme Court answered that question in the negative and referred to a delegation of rulemaking authority to an interstate compact agency as an axiom of modern government, and did not find that that was something that was constitutionally troubling. The citation is 341 U.S. 22, and it's a 1951 case, so it's certainly been out there for a while.
Thank you very much, because I'm going to take a look at that, and when this is debated on the floor, I want to probably put that on the record that we've investigated this, and this is not an unconstitutional rulemaking provision. Let me ask you just one final question, I think, Mr. Chair. Is there, Mr. Masters, through the chair, is there any other potential constitutional issue that you're aware of? And if so, I'd like to know how it's been resolved, and it may be that you want to respond in writing to that, because I want to be sure that we're on firm legal ground here. And this, by the way, I'm sure will serve us well as we look at other compacts, too.
Absolutely. I would point out to you that in Article 18, there is a specific exception for any aspect of this that might be subsequently determined to conflict with the Constitution of the state of Alaska, and that the compact would certainly be subservient to any constitutional provision. That would also allow any amendment that you felt necessary, if there were such, that you felt might be in conflict with the state constitution. We certainly are mindful of the prerogatives and the sovereign authority of each state, and this mechanism is subject to your constitution.
Mr. Chair, if I may ask one more question. I'm looking now at Article 18A2. It's on page 23, lines 31 through page 24, line 1 of our bill, and I think it's important. Quote, all member states, that's S apostrophe, laws conflicting with this compact are superseded to the extent of the compact. As I understand compacts, they take precedence even over state constitutions. Am I right or wrong on that?
They don't, if there's a provision such as there is in this one that specifically states, and that's in the very next section from where you're reading, that states that in the event any provision of this compact exceeds those constitutional limits, then they would give way to the Constitution. In addition, the context of this particular clause is that since a compact is also a contract, then like any other contract, even though this one is between states, you don't unilaterally change the deal without going back to your co-signatories or the other parties and saying, you know, hey, we think this should be changed. So in that sense, that would prevent the agreement from being unilaterally amended in a way that might not be in the interest of all the member states.
And finally, Mr. Chair, if this is subsequently amended by an agreement, does that require legislative approval?
To the extent it would amend any of the articles of the compact, it would. And with respect to any regulation, certainly if you felt it was constitutionally required, the legislature could review those, and there is a provision in the compact that states that the legislatures of the states can veto a regulation if they find it unacceptable.
This might be something, I'm looking at the other members of the committee here. It sounds like if we wanted those rulemaking regulations to be subject to legislative approval, that might be something that we would put in this as a separate section, not part of the compact, but a separate section that would require them to come to the legislature for approval. Am I correct on that, Mr. Masters?
You are, and if the Alaska Constitution would require such, it certainly would be your prerogative to do so. And I know of at least one other state where that's the case.
Thank you. That's very thought-provoking, and I'd never thought of that before. I told Ms. Lidster last week I had no questions. I'm sorry, Karen. That completes my questions, although I think maybe at some point I'll talk to Representative Coghill about that one.
Thank you. Are there questions from other members for Mr. Masters? I don't see any. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify? Commissioner, we thank you, and Director Jeans, we thank you also for your help. Karen, you did a fine job in presenting this bill. At this point, I'm going to close public testimony. We don't have anybody else online, I don't believe, that wants to testify. We're going to bring the bill back before the committee. Representative Gruenberg, do you have any amendments that you wish to offer on this bill?
No, I will just discuss that latter point with Representative Coghill. Right, I'm not going to...
Away from the committee table. We thank you for that. We thank you for the thorough vetting and putting so much information on the record. We're all very grateful.
Mr. Chair, I'm just...
Representative
Gruenberg. Yeah, I was... yes. And I want us to get the other bill, too, and everything out. But we have so seldom had somebody of Mr. Masters' background to deal with compacts. And Representative Coghill has taken us through several compacts in the last few years, and I don't know what the wish of the committee is, but at some point maybe there are other compacts this committee ought to look at, and this is a very important issue, and I'm sorry I took up so much
time. We all are listening to you dialogue, Representative Gruenberg. Some of us just can't get enough.
You want a motion?
I'm just dying for one, Representative.
I'll wait a while then. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 137, 24-LS0588, /R, from this committee with individual recommendations. And is there a fiscal note back here?
Yes, there is.
Attached fiscal note.
Attached fiscal note. Seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign this. Thank you. Our trusted friend is going to present this. Representative Coghill, this bill needs to be introduced. Would you introduce this bill, please?
This is the P version?
This is P as in Peter, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that we take for our working document the CS for House Bill 108 Judiciary, that is the 26LS0318/P version.
I'm going to object for the purpose of the explanation of the differences, and do it at any time.
All right, Representative Gruenberg objects. Jane, will you take us through that, and then we'll adopt the CS version as satisfied, Representative Gruenberg?
Yeah.
For the record, my name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramirez, and I will walk you through the changes between this, the P version, and the R version that passed out of House L&C. In Section 2, AS0935140 adds back into the bill the requirement that the notice of execution and sale of real property also be noticed on an internet website. The new language, however, expands the list of qualified sites, so that newspapers of general circulation, provided they meet the requirements proposed in AS0935140, which says if a newspaper qualifies to run legal ads, it'll be qualified to run the internet publication. The only other qualifier that was added is that any of the internet sites be free to the viewing public. So now newspapers will also be added into the internet websites. In Section 4, there is a requirement added under AS 4320-070E that the notice of default served on the trustor include language stating that the payment to cure the default must be made 2 days prior to the sale date stated in the notice of default, or 2 days prior to the date which the sale date is postponed, and this should give adequate notice to the trustor of this 2-day cure provision. In AS 3420070E, there is conforming language back to Section B. And the only other change was in Section 10, AS 3420080J, as new language that states that as the sale is rescinded under G of the section, the deed of trust foreclosed in the rescinded sale is restored to the validity and priority it would have been had the sale not occurred, or that the sale had occurred, excuse me.
Representative Grunberg.
Since I had the objection, may I inquire on one thing, please?
Certainly.
The member should have that explanation on this little sheet here. That may help. Looking, Ms. Pearson, at Section 4 of the bill, which adds the 2-day provision, is that the language on page 4, line 20?
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg,
yes.
Through the chair, it actually is added under subpart 8, and it goes into 3420080E, which is the original notice of default. So it would appear in the original notice. It's the only difference.
What page and line of the bill?
Okay. Eight. We're starting on page 4, line 20 to 21, which is the place where it says to go look under 3420080E. Then we go to page 8 under section 9, where the language is set out. That's
right. And members, we have testimony from Stephen Routh, who helped bring this bill before the committee, as well as Dan Fowsky and Brian Butcher from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, who are both available for questions, and Mr. Robert Schmidt and out of Anchorage, who's speaking for himself.
I will withdraw my objection so the bill is in front of us.
Thank you.
And then if Jane or somebody can answer that at some point here.
Okay, so we have the CS for House bill, version P as in Peter, is now before us. Members have questions for Jane Pearson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a
Homes. And also this bill came from Labor and Commerce, mm-hmm. where a number of members sit on, and it goes to the floor from here, so it does not have a Finance Committee referral. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is kind of a silly little technical thing. On page 1, we have 0935140 in section 1, and then in section 2, we add a B and a C section to that. But it doesn't appear that the first section is A. Do we need to add a sort of a little lowercase a in parentheses? Do we need to make that subsection A now that we are adding a B and C section?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, that would be cleaner.
Okay, so that would be a conceptual
amendment
at the
appropriate time. I would like to do that. Thank you.
Okay, are there other questions for the bill sponsor? Let's take testimony. We can always
Jane
back.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Thank you. Thank you.
Jane, do you have something you want to add?
Yes, Representative Ramos, Representative Gruenberg through the chair. I think I misspoke because in Section 8, it says the statement described the cure for default. This is all put under the original notice.
It looks like
Representative Gruenberg?
It looks like, Ms. Pierce, through the chair, that in the new bill, it's on page 5, lines 15 to 17, the 2-day requirement. And I'm trying to see where that is. I don't see anything similar on page 3, lines 20 to 25. But I don't want to take up time for the witnesses now. Let's do the witnesses.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Okay, let's go to Robert Schmidt, please, in Anchorage. Mr. Schmidt, are you with us?
Yes, Your Honor.
The floor is yours. Would you introduce yourself and any affiliations that you may have and offer your testimony?
Yes, my name is Robert Schmidt. I'm an attorney in the law firm Grow Eggers LLC. It's my belief that, second to Mr. Rouse's firm, our firm handles is the number two foreclosure processing firm in the state. Having said that, we process, I'd say, about 100 foreclosures a year, and I've heard Mr. Rouse say that his combined offices throughout the West Coast handle 4,000 foreclosures a month, that is to say 48,000 foreclosures a year. I testified previously when this bill was in the Labor and Commerce Committee, and my primary objection at that time related to internet publication. I've looked over, I was handed the current draft of this bill about 45 minutes ago. It appears that most of my concerns relative to internet publication, that is, that there would be monopoly power granted in a website owned by Mr. Routh, have been addressed, although there may be some issues with internet publication for remote foreclosures. For example, it's my understanding, I'm not certain, but I believe the Arctic Sounder in Barrow does not have a website, and therefore, if you were conducting a foreclosure sale in Barrow, where the nearest newspaper didn't have a website, you would then be forced to use Mr. Rouse's internet website. But as a general matter, my concerns relative to internet publication appear to have been addressed. I have a great deal of good things to say about this bill. For example, if there is a foreclosure auction and there is extra money left over from the foreclosure auction, this bill codifies how the title company or trustee disperses those funds. It removes the requirement that we post notices in a post office because most post offices will not accept our documents. And it does other favorable things. There is an issue now relating to the two-day cutoff. The intent of the bill is that if somebody is behind on their payments, they can stop the foreclosure by paying the payments that are due plus fees and other charges as long as they make that payment 2 days before the sale. The current practice is that at any time prior to the sale, if they make a payment that cures the default, the sale must stop. That creates concerns where a payment might be made to a teller at a bank branch minutes before the foreclosure sale occurs and the bank is not aware that the payment has been made. I do not have strong feelings about the two-day requirement because the banks that I represent, in-state lenders, for the most part, would never turn down a cure, and they would rather the person keep the property rather than go through with the foreclosure. But in this newly introduced version, it is, as I read it, and I have not had much time to review it, it makes the two-day rule mandatory. In other words, it requires the bank to state that they are not, that they will not accept cures tendered within 2 days of the foreclosure sale. It's my understanding that that is not what was intended in this revision, and I've got some wordsmithing changes that I'd be happy to discuss with the committee. But as it is, I believe that the two-day rule is not worded the way it ought to be. I would also point out that there appears to be a typographical error on page 3 regarding internet websites, and I'm particularly referring to page 3, line 4, where it says, if operated by a newspaper that is not covered by one of the subsections. And I don't think that the intention of that line is to involve newspapers at all. However, I may be mistaken. So I have concerns about how the two-day cutoff is phrased. I think that there might be a unintended typographical error relating to non-newspaper internet websites. But other than that, I would say that the bill is overall a very good one that would do much to modernize Alaska's foreclosure laws. Thank you.
This is Representative Coghill. Thank you, Stephan. The two-day question, are you referring to the page 5 portion of the bill, which is under 070E?
It occurs in a couple of places. It starts on page 4, line 17, where it says, and 9, the statement described in E of this section describing conditions for curing of the default, and then continuing on to where you refer to, page 5, line 12, where it says the statement required by B9 of this section must state.
Okay.
All right. And my concern, one, like I say, most in-state banks are not going to be interested, in my estimation and experience, in the two-day rule. If somebody brings money the day before, the day of, the banks are going to want to take the money and stop the sale. And I'm concerned that the language that has been used here unintentionally makes the two-day rule a requirement. My other concern that I didn't allude to earlier is that while I have not surveyed deeds of trust, it is my opinion, it is my professional opinion that most deeds of trust will conflict with this. I suspect that most modern deeds of trust executed within the last 10 years, will say you can stop the sale by curing the payment defaults before the sale. In other words, the deed of trust would grant broader rights than what this language does. I don't know that that's necessarily a reason for not having the two-day rule, and I understand that various out-of-state lenders who operate substantially higher loan portfolios would be benefited by this two-day rule, but I think that the way that it's worded now is not the way that, quite frankly, is even intended.
Okay, thank you. That helps me look through it. On page 5, line 12, the word required by then might come into question, especially under other rules of law then.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, yes. It might conflict. One, it might conflict with the provisions of the deed of trust itself, and then also it might raise policy considerations, especially, like I say again, for local banks that are not interested in the two-day rule and would gladly accept a payment cure rather than going through with the foreclosure sale.
Okay, well, this is Representative Coghill. The chairman had to step out, so I'm taking over the committee.
I'm glad I'm captivating everyone so well.
It's what we call a mini coup.
what we might do, since you only have today had to look at the bill, it would be a good idea if you were able to get that in writing to members of the committee, or especially to the chairman, to take a gander at it. So now that the chairman is back, I will uncoup myself. Mr. Chairman, I was just talking about on page 5, line 12, about the statement required by B9 might be in conflict, and so with other laws. So not being real savvy to this particular area of law, I think I would be willing to look into some. So that deals with a two-day requirement, and those that are allowed under, I think, is it must be bank contract law, probably, deeds of trust, that allow them to satisfy a debt up until the moment of sale, I would think. So just a thought, Mr. Chairman, then I'll leave it to you.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruber.
Mr. Schmidt raised another point. It was earlier in the bill, and it was on page 3, lines 4 and 5. I had requested of Representative Coghill that we ask Mr. Schmidt and anybody else, these other attorneys on the line, if they'd be willing to, with your permission, send us an email so we could take a look at these things.
It's a wise
idea. This is probably the committee that'll take the closest look at this bill, and we want it to be in good shape.
I agree, and we don't, I'd like for us to make a punch list of the concerns that we have here and then hold the bill over so that it does enjoy a thorough vetting here and moves out with the support of the committee, because although it's simple on its face, it's very complex in that it takes somebody's house from them. It's the process of taking somebody's home. So that's not lost on the chairman. At the same time, I don't want to lose sight of the good that this bill does, which is it's designed to rescue that equity and try and return it to the homeowner so that they have a nest egg to begin their life over again. So I don't want to get into the weeds on a technicality when, generally speaking, if you're down to those last 2 days, the borrower is no longer in a condition to remedy
this bill, and that the good in this bill outweighs this imperfection which has dogged the bill along the way. So I want to just make the members mindful of that. Are there more questions for Mr. Schmidt? We still have Mr. Routh to go to. Are there other questions for Mr. Schmidt? Mr. Schmidt, we thank you for your input on this, and if you can follow through on those instructions. Well, it's the same thing, Mr. Routh, insofar as what a notice would appear to be. You have our cell phone, our fax number or email, is that right?
Yeah, they're available online, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. All right, next, if we can go to Mr. Routh, and I will remind the members after that that Brian Butcher and Dan Fowski from Alaska Housing are with us, and we will not attempt to move the bill today, but we will try and move the bill swiftly when we pick it up, as Bill's previously heard. Hello, Mr. Routh. How are you, Stefan?
I'm fine, Chairman Ramirez. How are you?
Fine. Well, if you just introduce yourself for the record, we're happy to have you before us.
My name is Stefan Routh. I'm an attorney in Anchorage, Alaska, and been so for 27 years. I reside in Anchorage, and I'm representing myself and my firm today.
Thank you. And Stefan, just for clarification, because of Mr. Schmidt's reference to your work, he said that his firm does about 100 foreclosures per month, and he referred to you and your organization that you do about 4,000 foreclosures on the West Coast. Can you give us a sense of how much work you do in Alaska? That's the only state that we're interested in.
We would do, I believe Mr. Schmidt mentioned he does 100 a year. We would do substantially more than that, I believe, per month. We've been doing this for years. You know, our mission has changed over the years. We're pretty much, we've been instructed by our clients with our full concurrence to do everything we can to keep borrowers in their homes, and so hence this bill and efforts like this throughout the nation to try to streamline the process and make it more open and transparent.
Thank you, and if you, thank you very much, Stephanie. If you'll proceed with your testimony, please.
The changes in this from the prior the prior act, one was to broaden the definition of internet publication websites. The goal here is to widen the publicity for sales, because if a house is going to go to a foreclosure auction, irrespective, if the borrower cannot rescue that loan under any circumstances, then it's going to go into the foreclosure process. And the goal is to maximize the amount bid at the auction, which is a public auction, because the dollars there go back into the borrower's account. If the bids are more than what the borrower owes, then the borrower will enjoy the benefits of that, those funds, or his creditors will, that will also benefit the borrower. So the goal is to widen the scope of folks that become aware of auctions, that are interested in bidding, and take it beyond just the local newspaper, but take it to the whole world and the World Wide Web. And that's the way people shop nowadays for real estate, among other things, is on the web. So this just brings Alaska into that genre. We would be the third state now to actually do this. Florida's enacted legislation for this, as well as Arkansas. A previous Mr. Schmidt mentioned that there was monopoly powers granted to a website that we own. I never saw that, and I still don't see that, but he forgot to mention he has a website as well. But what I would mention is that now the newspapers who are qualified to run the legal notices will now be automatically qualified to run the internet notices. And he mentioned there might be one or two papers that don't have websites. But it's easy to set up a website, and there's no qualification period if they're a newspaper of general circulation. There's no threshold that they have to pass, only that they have to be of general circulation as a newspaper, which they already would be. And secondly, the website has to be free so people can get to it without paying money, which all moves in the direction of making this an open process. The other comment, if I may discuss the 2 days, the goal there was that to move the date of cure of a loan up a little bit. And the reason is that this is a time when litigation occurs because there's problems of, you know, a state as big as Alaska, somebody pays off a loan in a branch in a remote area for a sale happening in a populated area or vice versa. And so the property is sold, maybe to a third party, but the loan's been paid off or reinstated, but nobody knows it because of remoteness. So So this moves that time of payoff or reinstatement back a bit so that doesn't happen. When that happens, when there is an issue of somebody paying off but nobody knows about it timely enough to prevent the auction, then there's litigation and the borrower might lose the home. There's all kinds of problems that are going to occur. So this just pushes it back a little bit so there's a breathing space. I agree with Mr. Smith that no bank today would ever object to taking those funds to pay off and reinstate that home. That's what they want. But this just has a little breathing space at that point in the sale so that we don't have a situation where at the last minute everything happens, which results in litigation and unhappy people because a home's been sold that shouldn't have been. And with that, I'd be pleased to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Representative Holmes has a question for you, Steph.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ralph, what do you think about the testimony that was given by Mr. Schmidt that you might have situations where the deed of trust allows you to cure a default right up until the moment of the sale, but this law would create a two-day window? Which would trump the other? Would the deed of sale provisions, the contractual provisions trump, or would the statutory provisions trump?
We've looked at that, and our firm belief is that the deed of trust provisions would prevail. If it allows cure up to the moment of sale, that's what it is.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I may have a follow-up.
Certainly.
So then, if now I'm looking at Section 6 on page 5, and again at that language on line 12 that Mr. Schmidt brought up, that it would require the statement to say that it could only be cured up to 2 days before the sale date. If legally, under the contract, the deed of trust contract, somebody could show up an hour before or 5 minutes before and pay it off, but now we're putting legal notices that they have to do it 2 days before. Doesn't that create a problem?
Yeah, I think it could. This language, interestingly, was put in at the request of Mr. Smith. and so, we hadn't fully, I guess, vetted the repercussion of what happens if the deed of trust says something contrary to now what he has asked that we put in the in the notice of sale. I think there is an issue there. What I'd be pleased to do is send an email. We have done some analysis, I think, and we can certainly use some more on that to see what the repercussion would be. I realize the issue would be confusion in the borrower, and we don't want that to happen. We want to make it clear to the borrower what the rules are. I should also point out that I believe the language in deeds of trust that set the time for cure is a very, very small percentage of the deeds of trust that we use in Alaska. When we looked at this last time, it was older versions of the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac uniform instrument, which that version went away several years ago. So I don't know, I guess, first of all, how much of a problem it is, but secondly, I'd be glad to address it with a little more analysis.
Thank you. Because, Mr. Chairman, if I may, this is sort of the last remaining concern I have. I think this is a good bill. I think it's got a lot of good things in here. I think we've made great progress on the Internet, and I want to see this bill move forward, but this two-day, especially if we're creating conflicts between contracts and statute and other things, this is the last remaining concern I have with the bill. So I appreciate all of your comments, and I appreciate the follow-up that you've both promised, both you and Mr. Schmidt have promised.
Thank you. Are there more questions for Mr. Ralph? I don't see any at the table. We thank you very much, Stefan, for weighing in, and we're going to try and pick up this bill, and you're going to forward us a copy of what an Internet ad would look like so that the committee can have it before us. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd ask Mr. Schmidt and Mr. Ralph, and maybe if there's somebody else on the line who's involved with this, if they can communicate amongst yourselves beforehand and maybe come to us with a joint recommendation on something to do, maybe that would help so that everybody gets their ducks in a row. Do you think you guys could do that?
Representative Grunberg, by the chair, I'd be pleased to meet with Mr. Smith and do that. Is that specifically addressing the two-day requirement?
And anything else, whatever you wish.
Yeah, okay, be pleased to do it.
Yeah, Representative Grunberg, this is Mr. Schmidt. We have actually, Stefan and I have talked, and as indicated, I was the one that brought up the concerns regarding the two-day rule, and I did propose language, although I am highly confident the language I proposed to him is not the language that was ultimately used. But yes, we have coordinated we have coordinated among ourselves on other issues, and I'm sure we can do so in the future.
Thank you, gentlemen. The committee would like to get this bill out of here in the next couple of days, though. So we will consider that the two of you have met. By the time that we see something come across electronically here, we're all watching the clock and recognize that bills are going to have a hard time making it to the other body here. Beginning next week, really. So if you can accomplish that this week, would be terrific. We thank you. We have Brian Butcher and Dan Fowski available for questions. Are there any questions from members to these two gentlemen? Representative Gruenberg.
Yes. Is Mr. Butcher with AFC?
They're both, yes. Brian Butcher with they're both with Alaska Housing.
I'd ask to both of you, if I may, through the chair very briefly. Have you had a chance to look at the P as in Papa version, folks?
This is, for the record, this is Brian Butcher, Public Affairs Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Mr. Fowski just got called to a separate meeting. We have not. We have the list of changes, however, between the two versions, and we were supportive of the previous bill. The only issue in looking at this is the previous issue brought up by Mr. Schmidt, and I'm confident that between Mr. Routh and Mr. Schmidt that issue can be resolved.
Yeah, just speaking personally, if you have any concerns as you review this, I'd like to hear them, and I know the chair and the members would also.
Yes, you mean now?
No, as you're reviewing it, because they just got this.
Absolutely. Brian, we thank you very much for taking a look at that. It is 10 minutes of 3. We have a full agenda for the week. We still have death penalty to take up. And we'll see when that is deferred to. We continue to wait till we have a full committee to do that. At 10 to 3, we're adjourned.